I will call the Civil Law and Data Practices. We'll call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order for April 7th. We do have a quorum. Representative Hoppe, would you like to move the minutes from last time?
Madam President, we'd be honored.
Representative Hoppe moves the minutes from March 31st. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of March 31st, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. The first bill up today is Representative Baker. Welcome to the committee, Representative Baker. Go ahead. Let's see. Representative Johnson, would you like to move this bill?
Yes, I would.
Representative Johnson moves House File 1652 before the committee and that it be re-referred to the General Register. Go ahead, Representative Baker.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. If I may, we have an amendment with the bill as well. If I could, I'd like to add the amendment at this time to get the bill in the order that I'd like to talk about this with.
All right, members, looks like we have an A4.
Yes.
I will move the A4. Any discussion on the A4? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A4 is amended onto House File 1652. Go ahead, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, just a brief update on what A4 is actually doing is it's actually removing one of the worries, I believe, that this committee had last year when we were in front of civil law, and it requires us to leave the law the way it is right now, collecting data on patients for more than 2 years. And it puts it back to the original version. So that's what that does. I think it actually should help the process a little bit more. Why we're here again, Madam Chair, we talked to this body a year ago about the prescription monitoring program. At that time, I was learning an awful lot about a very complicated issue. And because it's personal, because I understand the need for good practice when it comes to prescribing medications. In today's world, we have a new concern, and that's called opioids. You see it in the paper every single day, and it is taking a lot of lives, and I'm concerned that we aren't getting the attention and the prescribers, the dentists, the doctors, the eye surgeons are not utilizing a tool enough that is at their disposal to help patient care and to make sure that families and loved ones are getting the best possible care that there is. So this bill really is the same as what you saw last time, except what I did last year when I went through HHS reform. I was nervous about an area that I pulled out of the original bill, which was requiring doctors to have a login to the prescription monitoring program. The reason I pulled it out before is I called a large clinic back in my area in Wilmer, ACMC, and I said to the administrator, this is my bill, here's what I'm thinking. He said, the only thing that makes me nervous is that you're requiring us to have a, sign in or, have a login. I thought, okay, I was listening to my constituents, I want to make sure I don't create more work for other folks that are under a lot of pressure every day. And so I took it out, and today I'm here putting it back in, really, because a year later, I talked to the same clinic of 125 doctors, and they already have instituted, they require their doctors now to do it on their own. They have seen the need, they've seen the changes in 1 year time about the escalation of this problem. Currently, again, roughly 25% of dentists have a login for the program. About 34% of doctors have a login to the program. About 63% of the pharmacists that have the ability to do this are using the program, have a login in the program. I think those numbers fall way short of what we need to do when we are dealing with opioids for our loved ones. And so, Madam Chair, with me today to just tell about a personal story is Ms. Kelly Larrabee. And I guess if I could, Madam Chair, I'll turn over the rest of the testimony and we'll see who else wants to speak to the bill.
Sounds good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Kelly Larrabee. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. A few weeks ago, I watched a news story, and I knew immediately that I needed to contact Representative Baker, my life and my marriage would be drastically different if the prescription monitoring program that Representative Baker proposes were already in effect. I can't give you an exact date as to when all of this began for me. At some point many years ago, the desire for pain medication and the pursuit to obtain that pain medication became a priority for the man that I once loved. I have been able to track prescriptions back to 2012 showing thousands of narcotic pain pills being prescribed by multiple doctors at multiple clinics and hospitals and being filled by different pharmacies. Since January 8th of 2016, I have records showing 224 oxycodone pills and 420 morphine pills that have been prescribed, along with 90 pills of a controlled substance called alprazolam. It's a drug used to treat anxiety and panic disorders. If you include the 128 Zolpidem, which is a sedative for insomnia, you get a grand total of 862 pills that have been prescribed in the last 90 days. I have no medical training, but I believe that all of these drugs together, taken together, would cause a contradiction in the desired results and benefits. In fact, I actually see that on almost a daily basis. The want and the need to obtain these pills is a full-time occupation at this point. I have copies of signed narcotic pain medication contracts from different clinics and letters from clinics indicating that he is no longer allowed to have medication filled because of the behaviors he has exhibited when he has been denied a refill. Those contracts may be effective on paper, but in daily life they're almost impossible to enforce. I honestly never know what to expect when I go home. The medications have created bizarre and aggressive behaviors that is routinely used to intimidate. I've watched medical facilities react in his favor just to calm him down. I have attempted on so many occasions to try to contact the doctors in the clinics and inform them of my concerns of narcotic abuse. I have spoken with the pharmacies filling these prescriptions. Each time I've been told that they cannot speak to me because of the current laws protecting the privacy. Honestly, I am in full support of all of the privacy laws. But I think more can be done to help protect not only the patient, but the families and the communities. Processes can be put into place that will create an added check and balance while still protecting the privacy of the individuals. This bill does protect and add that balance. At home right now, I have a 16-year-old son. 10 years ago, his father used to take him to Timberwolves games. They used to go to monster truck shows, wrestling matches, and high school football games. There is a less than basic interaction between these two now. My son loves his father and doesn't understand why they can no longer participate in activities together anymore. He doesn't understand why they can't just sit at home on a weekend afternoon and watch a sporting event on TV or a movie with a big bowl of popcorn. I don't know how to explain this to my son. The pursuit of medication has destroyed that father bond, that father-son bond. The day-to-day goal is completely focused on finding new medical scenarios that will allow him to obtain medication. There is a level of pathological lying that occurs in every interaction that he has each day. Sadly, he honestly believes these words he uses and does not understand there is a problem. There is a high level of paranoia and an unjust entitlement to have everything given to him. He now associates with people who have the same interests. He has destroyed relationships with extended family members and with friends of many years. I can do nothing to help change any of the scenarios in our life because of the current laws that are in place. It is too late for me to repair this, but it is not too late to help me prevent it for others. Now, the amount of information that I have is considered private information, but it was obtained from paperwork that's just lying around my house. I am not asking that the world have access to all of our private records. It does seem reasonable to suggest that the doctors prescribing these opioids are required to take the extra step to ensure the medications are not being excessively prescribed by other providers. My story is really not that uncommon in the world today. This is a true epidemic, and I believe it is worth the extra security step to regulate the monitoring these prescriptions. I wish that I could ask the doctors so many questions. I would start with, are you aware of his drug history? Do you know the variety of medications that he is being taken? Why aren't you focusing on that drug history? What concerns me here is, who are we really protecting at this point? All I'm asking today is that you please consider offering your support and passing the prescription monitoring program bill as proposed by Representative Baker. He is not requiring the use of this program, but he's providing the tools to use. Honestly, if it were me, I'd mandate it completely and require the doctors to use this system. I don't share my story for you to feel sorry for me today. I share my words today in the hope that you will understand the personal side of this issue. These pills have drastically changed the course of life for my family. I know that things would be different if the doctors had been able to look and see the quantities and the volumes of the different drugs that were prescribed. It scares me, and I think that you really need to take a look at this bill. Thank you for your time today, Madam Chair and members. I am happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Larrabee. Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Lesh?
Thank you. So just so I'm clear, Ms. Larrabee, you were acutely aware of your husband's abuse of these controlled substances, but would your proposal give you more access, or this is just about the doctors? Is that correct?
Ms. Larrabee?
This is just about the doctors. There are systems in place now. Had it not been for the paperwork lying around, I wouldn't have access to this. I don't need access to this. I don't know what these drugs are. It's the medical professionals who do know what these drugs are. They know what counteracts with one another. They know what too big of a volume is. They're the ones who need to monitor this, and they're the ones who need to take a look at what is out there.
Okay.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for Representative Baker. So I see that you're reinstating the line 3.15 with your amendment, saying that the data retained beyond 24 months must be de-identified. The statute of limitations for criminal conduct related to this behavior is 3 years. So why are we not at 3 years instead of 24 months? Just, again, if there's criminal activity now, you have eliminated one entire year of information about that criminal conduct.
Representative Baker?
Madam Chair and to Representative, I think that's a good question from the expert here, Cody Weiberg. Actually, I'm taking the same language that was there prior to this, so maybe he's got some historical background on that, Representative, so I'll turn that over to Mr. Weiberg.
Mr. Weiberg, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record, and if you can ask the question.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. The answer to that question is really twofold. The data that we are now allowed to keep for up to 4 years, but which we have to identify after 2 years, that was only that ability to keep data even that long was only given to us in the 2014 session. Prior to that time, we could only keep the data for up to 1 year at a time. Currently, the way that the law is right now is we can keep that data for 4 years, de-identifying it after 2 years, but anything after 1 year, still the only people that can look at that are my staff. And we use that to try to analyze how well the system's working. Any other user, doctors and other prescribers, pharmacists, law enforcement can come to us as well. They need a search warrant from a judge, but they can only get 1 year's worth of data, and that's always been the case since we started releasing the data in April of 2010.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it looks like originally as the bill was drafted, you intended to get rid of that sentence that said data retained beyond 24 months must be de-identified, and then now it's being reinstated back to current law. What was the reason that you were attempting to eliminate that sentence?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the things that we've been very fairly asked to do is to analyze how well this program works. And after consulting with our database vendor and experts around the country on how to study these systems, we were told we needed 4 years of identifiable data because of limitations of how the data is reported. We don't collect people's Social Security numbers. We have no way of having one unique identifier for each person. So when you look at our data, I use the example of someone named William Johnson. One pharmacy might enter that person as William Johnson, the next might be Will, Bill, and so on. There are algorithms that are in there to try to make sure that we're looking at the same person. When you remove the data, those algorithms don't work. And so if we're going to do anything beyond like a two-year analysis of the data, if we're going to do a trend analysis, which by definition requires 3 or 4 years of data, we needed that. However, this was a very contentious issue in the 2014 session. As Representative Liebling has pointed out, there was a kind of a balance and a compromise that was reached. After that compromise was reached, we went back to our vendor and the experts again. They said, no, you need that 4 years worth of data, so we thought we would try to get it again, but there's still quite a bit of resistance to that. And so in order to get the things that we think are most crucial in this bill, which is what's left in the bill, we've agreed to go ahead and have that taken out.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weiberg, I don't have specific recollection of the bill from last year on that point, but I was wondering about data sharing. So what agencies then hold and retain this, and who do they share it with? Who can they share it with?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, the only state agency that can actually look at this data is the Board of Pharmacy. We can't, I take that back, DHS has the ability to look at it as well. So those are the two agencies. We can't share the data with researchers at Health Department or someone at the University of Minnesota. Even our use of the data is basically to analyze the system, mostly. As part of that 2014 compromise, we were allowed to start looking at the data and to work with our advisory committee to come up with criteria to identify people that might be doctor shopping. And that's one of the things we want here in this bill, is to have the sunset of that process removed, because we've actually shown that works. We have a pharmacist that looks at that data. We get data from the medical board about specialties that physicians might have. So she's trying to eliminate false positives. In the criteria that we use, it's not someone just once in a while taking controlled substances. For her to do anything, this person has to have many different controlled substance prescriptions in a 30-day period of time that have been written by many different prescribers and filled at many different pharmacies. And that's a pretty classic indication that somebody is doctor shopping. But even then, she looks at the data, and if all those physicians are oncologists, we don't send out letters because we assume this person has cancer. So that's how we use the data. DHS uses the data because they have what they call their lock-in program. They're already using their own claims data, but one problem, I used to be the Medicaid Pharmacy Program Manager for DHS, one problem they have is the Medicaid recipients who pay cash. That doesn't show up in their data. They use our data with their data to identify people they think are doctor shopping, and they've been able to do this for 25 years at least, and they restrict those recipients to go to one primary care physician, one hospital, and one emergency room. So those are the only two state agencies that actually use the data.
Well, Representative Lash. Madam Chair and Mr. Weiberg, what I'm wondering for is I'm looking in these permissible sharing provisions in Section 4, and they seem to be pretty broad. So I'm wondering, because it names the personnel or designees of a health-related licensing board, let's say that in a rural county in Minnesota, I've decided that I have a public health crisis, whether it could be methamphetamine or it could be opioids. And so I make my designee, the county sheriff, to help determine what exactly is going on, because they have the investigative capacity that someone else may not. And what is to prohibit, let's say, a law enforcement agency like a sheriff from them doing a sweep based upon everyone who's prescribed more than what is considered an average amount of particular opioid and then knocking on their doors? Is there anything in the bill that would specifically prohibit that?
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, there's something in current law that would prohibit that. The law enforcement is specifically named as someone who can get the data, but it specifically says they have to get a search warrant. And so we would not give data to any law enforcement agency without a search warrant. And I should mention that what I explained is current law. One of the third thing that we think is important here is we are now the only health licensing board that is allowed to look at the data to investigate our own complaints. And we use it very rarely, but in those cases we use it is when we've got a very specific complaint about a licensed pharmacist who himself or herself is doctor shopping. When that the new language that we're proposing here applies only to health licensing boards. Those are state agencies like the Board of Pharmacy, so Board of Medical Practice, nursing. The way that it would work is they would not have direct access. And when it talks about designee, the way the boards work, the boards themselves are appointed by the governor, but they delegate the authority to their employees to actually do the work. So that's what we're talking about, is the complaint coordinator for the Board of Medical Practice would have to come to my staff, show us that they got a complaint about a specific person, that they were themselves doctor shopping, or an anesthesiologist in the operating room impaired. And then we would give them the data. They would not have direct access.
Thank you. I guess I'm just wondering, that provision that you stated that requires a search warrant for law enforcement, mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that off the top of your head, do you? But if I just like the information later so I can see it.
That's well, Mr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, Representative Valesh, it's all in 152.126. I don't recall the exact subdivision right now, but it's all in there.
I'll look it up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair. Oh, okay. If I could direct committee members to page 4 of the bill, line 4.30. That lays out the statute regarding the search warrant. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you use this database if a doctor or a nurse makes a complaint that someone has taken their identity and is fraudulently phoning in prescriptions under their name, or is that one of the uses?
Mr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes. What we do is we allow a prescriber to do a search on their own DEA number. and they can do that search, and that will give them information about every prescription that was reported to our database using their DEA number. And we have actually helped at least a half a dozen physicians over the year whose identities essentially were fraudulently stolen so that they could change their DEA number. And then we don't act on it ourselves, but then they can contact the local pharmacies in their area and say, yeah, I've confirmed there were a whole bunch of prescriptions written out in my name that I never wrote.
Thank you. Representative Pilstrom, follow up. Any other member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill?
Madam Chair,
Representative Lesch.
I would just note that language that was pointed out to me, that is permissive, not restrictive. So there is nothing in there saying that that I see that the public health board could not designate law enforcement, thereby sidestepping the warrant requirement located in Grams 8, but that's maybe
Thank you for those comments, Representative Lesch. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Twyla Braes. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And we'd just like to start out by saying that freedom is precious. So precious, in fact, that people risk their lives to come to this country. But freedom can be lost by the acts of the well-intended, including those who have experienced personal tragedies. Freedom is enshrined in the U.S. Constitution and our state constitution, which both include the words of the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches and seizures of our persons, homes, papers, and effects, including the need for search warrants based on probable cause. This monitoring system is already a violation of those rights, and this bill to add investigational powers would only exacerbate and expand this violation. As we have discussed with Representative Baker, our organization opposes House File 1652 because of its impact on privacy rights, due process rights, and patient care. When the prescription monitoring program was first proposed in 2007, it was touted as a helpful tool for physicians to prevent doctor shopping. But in a significant turnabout, this bill would allow the system to be used increasingly against physicians. On line 4.16, health-related boards and their designees could use the data without a search warrant to look for physicians and other prescribers engaged in drug sales, drug possession, and other crimes in the fifth degree that carry a sentence of imprisonment up to 5 years and a fine of up to $10,000, according to line 4.20 and 4.21. Given what Mr. Weiberg said, we would look at what he would be able to do as a designee, as essentially being an arm of law enforcement. In addition, on line 3.8, the bill deletes the current prohibition on using the database to substantiate a disciplinary action against a prescriber. Lines 5.12 to 5.15 allow investigations of alleged inappropriate prescribing of controlled substances. So first, who defines inappropriate? Second, this proposed change seems to mean that as long as the board has a complaint, an allegation, they don't need a search warrant to search for unusual or excessive prescribing. But if they don't have a complaint, current law on line 3.4 prohibits such use of the database without a search warrant or a court order by the permissible user. So imagine with me if the issue in this bill was wiretapping our phones based merely on the allegation of a crime. Finally, we oppose the prescriber registration mandate on line 5.16. Every physician, prescriber, and pharmacist must register with the monitoring system whether they use the system or not, whether they even prescribe narcotics. What precedent does this set? Does this mandate set for the practice of medicine? What precedent does it set for any state database? And could there be a malpractice or criminal allegations if a doctor is not using the system to check in with the state when they are registered to do so? Last week, at least two people voted against this bill, and we believe it was Representative Liebling and Representative Dean who both spoke out against it. We appreciated the thoughtful statement Representative Matt Dean gave in his opposition to the bill. He asked, and I quote, "Where is the most addiction happening, and where is the problem area, and is that really going to be helped by this physician monitoring program? Or is this just going to be bigger government and more intrusion and more hoops for a doctor to jump through and more liability when we're not actually causing any less opioid addiction, less overdoses, less death? To protect our freedoms, we ask you to vote no on House File 1652. And I would like to add, in response to Representative Lesch's questions, there are two places in the statute that mention search warrant. One is the one that was pointed out to you, but the other one is on line 3.4, having to do with permissible users, not being able to use it specifically for looking for excessive prescribing without a search warrant or a court order. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the testimony. This, just in my own personal life, my father-in-law, who's passed away now, he did doctor shop uppers, downers, and sleepers. Because he got up, he couldn't fall back to sleep, so he'd take a sleeper. At one time, he was taking 11 different pills at a time, and he passed out in the bathroom. And when they took him to the hospital, the doctor said, you're taking so many different medications, your body doesn't know what to do, so you just collapsed, okay? And it caused a tremendous amount of family problems, and it eventually went in for treatment a couple of times, but he came back out and he did the same thing. So I see the problem of doctor shopping. He would go to different doctors until he found one that would prescribe him what he wanted, okay? And, you know, you see the advertisements on TV with the, you know, this medication is going to help you do this, all right? And but anyway, needless to say, I think we're overprescribed in a lot of areas in our life, but that's probably another area. But okay, there is a problem. I see the problem. Obviously, Representative Baker has a personal problem or situation, a very egregious, and I've seen it myself firsthand. If this bill's not the solution, is there a solution? I don't want to burden the doctors either. I understand some of the concerns you bring up. But if this bill's not the solution, my mother-in-law turned to so many different places for help with her with my father-in-law doing this, and she pretty much was stonewalled. There was not much they could do. And she felt helpless, and yet it was had a terrible effect on the family structure and situation. So, do you have any ideas on how to address it if this is the wrong way of addressing it?
Ms. Brace.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, when I look at policy, I look at the principles. So we have a problem, and there are ways to probably solve it, but there are other things that won't be solved. And when I look at what the principles are, and when I look at the basis of this country, the basis of our freedom, there's always a risk when you're free. But there is a greater risk when you're not. We could all be, perhaps another way to say it is, we could all be saved from these types of terrible things happening if we were just all under, and I realize this is sort of, you know, over the top, but if we were all under 24/7 surveillance, if we were all, you know, cared for, kept, right? We wouldn't have this happening, but there are just risks with freedom, and we have personal choices. So one of the things, if we want to look even beyond that, for opioids, et cetera, we have in our healthcare system a problem of third-party payment for everything, right? Which means that people don't have to pay the bills for all of those pills. So there are things even in the healthcare system itself and the way that the payments are working today that leave people with more freedom, as it were, in this case, to use somebody else's money to get themselves in trouble in this way. So there are things like that that can be done. But increasing law enforcement, increasing the power of the state over doctors and patients is against the principles that we believe this country was founded on.
Representative Grunhagen.
Okay, thank you for that comment. Just one follow-up. You know, there's an article in the Minneapolis Tribune that I think it was 54% of doctors are burnt out with requirements, okay? You know, between the HMO requirements, Obamacare MinSure requirements, and one requirement onto the next, they're spending more time fulfilling requirements than taking care of the patients. So, you know, I understand that balance, but you know, when I look at my mother-in-law, I think there should have been some type of outlet for her over the years where my father-in-law was abusing the system, and yet, you know, no matter where she turned, she just got door slammed in her face. And so I don't know. I don't know if this is the right solution. I don't know if it'll help either. I know the doctors are getting overwhelmed with this stuff, and they're doing more. They're becoming more paperwork people than they are treatment of what the actual healthcare problems are. And that's a, you know, a much bigger problem than this bill. But we're just adding more and more things to their agenda. So anyway, thank you,
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brace, quickly, please.
Yes, thank you. I just want to add to what Representative Grunhagen has said, because the fact of the matter is, as we turn doctors into more of the bureaucratic structure than the caregiving provider, we leave them with less time to take care of the patient, to talk to the patient, to get at the heart of the patient, and we encourage more pill giving, because a lot of doctors will tell me, well, I've been told I've got five or seven minutes or 8 minutes at the most, and with the patient, and the chart is waiting, and I have to fill all those checklists out, and I have to make sure that we can get paid and that we have done everything for all of these measurements that are on there. When you separate the doctor from the patient, you encourage pills. And when you encourage pills, you encourage this problem. But again, we don't believe in increasing the police force powers of the state.
Thank you. Representative Baker, final word.
Madam Chair, again, I think Representative Grunhagen brings up a very good point. This bill is hard to make perfect because of the balance that I'm sort of asking for. I don't want to have any more work for the docs. That's why I pulled it out before when I talked to my docs in my region. Now they're doing it on their own because they know the importance. We have an epidemic here, and this is a one tool that the intent of this is, if you have a login account, you may not use it for 6 months, but you might have a hunch with a patient that Twyla is bringing up that may have a hunch that you need that care, but you've got another tool that's all set up. So it'll take you a minute and a half to check the PMP program, but if you don't have an account, you probably won't check it. So this bill helps providers create that account, and let's that's what I'm looking for. So with that, Madam Chair, I would appreciate your support, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I actually come with personal experience, not only in my family, but as my job, former job as a deputy sheriff. Ms. Braz talked about personal choices. A mother was making a personal choice by bringing her children doctor shopping, not in the community we live in, but in the metro, going from doctor to get the narcotics that she needed. That her personal choice was endangering her children. And because of this program, a pharmacist caught it and called our office. Did I charge that person? No. Did I do a report? Yes. But we got that person to get the treatment she needed, and now they're doing wonderful. We don't always use this information to put people in jail. We do it to help people. And that's what this bill does, to help with the addiction. We have a major problem with opioid addiction. We have a problem with a lot of people doctor shopping. I know a couple people, but trying to get that information and getting them the help they need is very difficult. And with this bill, I believe that we'll be able to have a better shot of helping the people that need the help.
Thank you. With that, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1652, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill is adopted and moving to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Miller. Representative Miller, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 3370 and recommend that it be referred to the General Register. Do we have any amendments on this bill? I think we don't.
We do not, Madam Chair.
All right. Very good. Representative Miller, to your bill.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for this opportunity to share this bill that is very important to me. I'd like to begin by sharing a brief story of a woman that I met a couple of years ago. Now, today this woman is a very successful professional. She runs a department in one of our community colleges. She's a part-time nurse, and she has really proven how people can overcome things. Her life didn't start out quite so well that way. She was conceived to a single mom. While her mom was pregnant, she met a man, married that man, and over the years had three more boys. So it was a family of four. They didn't have a lot of money. They had a lot of struggles. They didn't have a lot of coping skills with things. And one of the big secrets in the life was that this woman, from the time that she can remember, from when she was born up through the age of 13, she was sexually assaulted by her stepdad. And this only came to light when, at age 13, she was pregnant and gave birth to a baby. She was taken out of the house and put into foster care. The man was arrested, charged, and sentenced to 90 days work release. This woman, she was in, back when she was 13 years old, she was in foster care for a year. After that year, moved back into the house with her mom, but her stepdad was back in the house as well. And that only terminated 6 months later when this man tried to sexually assault her again. And as a side note, he was not charged again and spent no more time in jail. Now, this was many years ago, and over the years, the laws have paid attention to things like this and have improved the situation, but we still have a couple areas that I believe that we need to fix. And so that is why I'm here today. And kind of as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story is that woman is my wife. And she's the most incredible woman that I ever met, but I'm very proud to carry this bill today because I think that there are other people, there are other children who are in similar circumstances, and we aim to fix that. My bill today, Bill 3370, is meant to take care of three things. It is, number one, it amends statutory language to require any information changes to be provided by a predatory offender in writing, and my testifier will explain the details on that. Number two, and this is most important to me, it authorizes child protection workers involved in evaluating whether a child can reside with a predatory offender to have access to registration data via the law enforcement agents with whom they are working. Right now, there's not a vehicle to be able to notify child protection workers. That's one thing that my bill aims to do. And then the third thing, quite simply, makes a technical correction related to previous recodification of civil commitment statute. So with that, I will pass it over to my testifier, Drew Evans, who's the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Before we get started with the testifier, if I could just have staff tell us what part of this bill addresses the civil law portion, because most of this bill deals with the criminal element, right?
Right.
So if you don't mind, Representative, we'll do that. Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, so I'd say there's no specific Chapter 13 new classifications in this bill, but Sections 3 and 2 do authorize some disclosure of data. It's the status of the predatory offenders to child protection workers, and that does have a data practices impact.
Thank you for that. Go ahead with your testimony. If you could focus on those issues, that would be great.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will focus on those two. Just very briefly, Section 2, as noted, will require explicitly changes to registration statuses in writing, and this is in response to a court case from the past year. What I will address more specifically for your committee is, as Representative Miller noted, this very important matter of sharing this information with Child Protection. Child Protection made changes to their statutes in the past year to make it a part of their job to determine if a predatory offender is residing in the home so that we have the most safe environment for children in this state. That change was made, however, the change was not made to the predatory offender registration statute to be able to allow us to share that information with Child Protection. So while they had this new duty to ensure that it was a safe environment for children, the predatory offender registration statute did not allow that disclosure. And this change will allow it so that we can disclose to Child Protection whether or not somebody is registered. Currently, Child Protection would only be able to see the 300 or so persons that are level 3 predatory offenders in Minnesota that are out of confinement. This change would allow us to be able to share the information on the 17,000 plus that would not be able to be shared with Child Protection currently.
Thank you, Mr. Sorensen. Are there any questions for this testifier or for the bill's author? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, I renew my motion that House File 3370 be passed and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Your Honor, I thank you so much for this good bill.
Thank you, Madam.
Up next, Representative Albright. Welcome to the committee, Representative Albright. Representative Zerwas, would you like to move House File 3199?
I will, Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 3199. And let's see, recommend that it be referred to the General Register. Representative Albright, do we have amendments? Are we taking those up now or later?
Madam Chair, if it would please you and the members, I'd like to just open up, make some brief summary conversations about the bill, and then we could hear from, I have a couple testifiers that would speak specifically to the provisions that would be pertinent to this board and this committee, and then we can take up the amendments afterwards.
Very well. Let's proceed with the areas that pertain to this committee.
Madam Chair and members, this is the Department of Human Services policy bill for this session. This is the second hearing that this bill has heard. It was first heard in Health and Human Services Reform. Annually, the Minnesota Department of Human Services submits to the legislature a series of policy changes for our consideration. These ideas come to the department from a variety of sources, stakeholders that they have been working with, legislators such as ourselves, and from department staff. In this bill, some of these changes are broad policy changes, for example, enacting standards for assertive community treatment. Some of the changes attempt to clarify past law changes that are that the department is having trouble implementing, such as foster care moratorium exceptions. And rather than myself presenting this bill in its entirety, I have requested that the department actually provides section by section information to you, identifying not only the topic but also the problem they are trying to solve and how they intend to address that problem. So with me, I have the first of two testifiers to that proposition. I will call your attention to, in the bill itself, the applicable articles that would be germane to your committee. Article 1, Section 5, Subdivision 2, which you can find on page 4, as well as Article 3, Section 2, Subdivision 2AB. And with that, Madam Chair, I would submit to you my first testifier.
Thank you. And if you could keep your comments just to those two sections, that would be appreciated. Go ahead with your testimony after you introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee members. I'm Jamie Sorensen with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Child Safety and Permanency Division. And I'm here talking about the item in Article 3 that's on page 38, beginning at line 38.23, related to review for child fatality and child fatalities. In 2015, the governor's task force on the protection of children and the legislature created a review team within the Department of Human Services to review child fatalities and near child fatalities that are the result of maltreatment, child abuse, or neglect. This proposed bill creates a standard around the information that aligns the information with what currently exists for the state child mortality review team. And in the context of these tragedies, this bill allows for these reviewers to use the information explicitly for to fulfill the duties of the review and no other purpose. And we believe this is important because these are very difficult matters, and for the protection of families who have lost children, and to also assure that as we do this work, the information throughout the review process stays at the same level of classification.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this testifier? Seeing none. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a question about another portion, but I'm not sure if there are other testifiers or if this is the person who's going to answer kind of all of our questions.
Representative Albright, do you have other testifiers regarding these sections that are taken up here in our committee?
Madam Chair, I have one other testifier that just wanted to elaborate on the exclusion of one of the sections that I did cite earlier that has been removed from the bill.
Okay, so it doesn't really pertain to, well, Representative Hilstrom, why don't you go ahead and say what your is it a section that's a reason that the bill's before our committee?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure, because so one of the requirements is that the group residential housing policy change would allow staff members to transport residents if they hold a valid driver's license from any state rather than requiring a Minnesota driver's license. And so I'd kind of like to talk about that provision. Now, if you don't think that that's appropriately here in this committee, I'm happy to talk about it on the floor or whatever. But I just have a couple questions about that particular
piece. Mr. Gehring, do you have a page number and a section, Representative Hilstrom?
Nope. I'll get it, though.
Okay.
Why don't we listen to the other testifier while
I look
for
it? Okay. Sounds good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Stacey Twite with the Department of Human Services. I just wanted to clarify that the changes that Representative Albright mentioned to Article 1, Section 5, Subdivisions 4 and 5, we removed the changes to these subdivisions in the earlier committee so that they wouldn't be here before you today. So there are no changes to those subdivisions in that article.
Okay, great. Thank you. You get the award for the shortest testimony today.
Great.
Any questions for this testifier? Thank you very much. Staff, did you find?
Madam
you haven't
Chair.
Found the section.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I believe that Representative Hilstrom's my questions. Ms. Dwight actually inferred to me that she might be available to answer those questions.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I did find the language. It states on line 43.14, it says they must hold a current, and it has Minnesota driver's license appropriate to the vehicle driven of transporting recipients, and they crossed out the word Minnesota. So my question is, why? And who is it that you think that is going to be driving these folks, given that in Minnesota, if you move to Minnesota, you're required to change a driver's license within a couple of days? I mean, is this for border cities? Is this for, I mean, who is this for?
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilstrom, that is correct. This is regarding our border cities, communities like Moorhead, where a staff member of a GRH facility may live in Fargo, let's say, but they work in Moorhead at a GRH facility. That staff member, perhaps as part of their job in the GRH program, is required to transport that person receiving services. So this is just saying that their North Dakota license would be acceptable.
Madam Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But that's only if they actually live in that state, right? You couldn't have moved to Minnesota, you know, a year ago, and you just didn't update your driver's license. So that would be if you actually reside in the state where that driver's license is from, so North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, or is it kind of exempting these folks from the requirement to transfer your license once you move to Minnesota?
Justifier.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilstrom, the intent is that they have a valid driver's license from any state. We're not trying to say they shouldn't have a driver's license by this change.
Representative Hilstrom.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That doesn't quite get to the answer, but I will certainly chat with her to make certain that they are actually complying with our driver's license rules and laws, not just having a valid, because you can have your driver's license suspended in Minnesota or revoked, or not have one at all and be from another state and have a valid license there, and some folks think you're valid to drive here. In fact, we have rules about that that makes it a crime.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier or on these two sections of the bill? Thank you. Did you have another comment?
I just wanted to clarify, if I might, Madam Chair and Representative Hilstrom. I think if this certainly wouldn't change the fact that if a person moved to Minnesota, they would have to get a valid Minnesota driver's license. We're just trying to specify for this program and your transporting clients that they need to have a valid license.
Okay, thank you. Representative Albright, did you want to go ahead and offer the A3 at this point?
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, the A3 is my amendment.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Representative Zerwas.
And I'll offer the A3 at this time. This is language that I have in another bill as well. This amendment would enact recommendations from the Office of Legislative Auditors report on MNSURE and the Minute IT governance structure, which has currently been used as the Executive Steering Committee. Right now, this group meets behind closed doors. No attempt to follow the open meeting law. No attempt to have input or transparency with the public. Most major discussions that occur at the Executive Steering Committee level that we've been able to find out deals with IT prioritization for fixing the MNSURE system and the METS enrollment eligibility system. And so this amendment would bring our sunshine language and add it onto this bill so we make sure that it's a continue of the discussion as we try to help counties in their efforts to get more transparency into the process. Some may not know that, you know, right now, if you enroll through the MNSURE portal website and into the bigger system, some which is the private marketplace, the bulk which is the public programs, it's about 92% public program enrollees and about 8% private program enrollees. The 92% of that is being paid by DHS, and the 92% of the enrollees are enrollees that counties need to interact with and help with enrollment issues, eligibility issues, and then technology issues and problems that have plagued the system from the beginning. Right now, in their current Executive Steering Committee, it does not include, I think it has one county representative, and so we want to make sure counties have more say since it more directly affects them. And so we just want to add this amendment on to make sure that this continues to be a part of the discussion.
Okay, the A3 is has been moved and is before us. Is there committee discussion? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to ask Representative Zerwas. I noticed in the amendment that the amendment would remove the Commissioner of Human Services from the MNSURE board, and just want to understand what the rationale was for that.
Representative Zerwas.
Yep, fair question, Representative Pinto. The move there, right now as it currently sets, the Executive Steering Committee has DHS representation. They develop, along with the head of Minute and the executive director, CEO of MNSURE, they develop these priorities and the IT prioritization. That thing gets put before the MNSURE board. And the way we look at it, DHS is involved at this executive steering committee level. They're putting the priorities in place. And then we feel they would have two bites at the apple if they also sit on the MNSURE board.
Representative Pinto, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, but to confirm, Representative Zerwas, sounds like you were talking about the IT part of it, but the MNSURE board obviously oversees all of MNSURE, and so I guess wouldn't it make sense the Department of Human Services would be necessary for it to be in that oversight role being on the board? Because I'm just trying to understand that.
Representative
Zerwas? Yep, so the Executive Steering Committee, I highlighted IT because that's the part that's impact, I think, most of our constituents, but almost all of the priorities that work their way up to the board as we understand it are developed through this Executive Steering Committee, then presented to the board in a presentation, and then past experience has been the board immediately approves it.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A3, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A3 has amended on to House File 3199. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill as amended? Seeing no one, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 3199 be recommended to pass as amended and re-refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. It's on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Smith.
That looks like a violation.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, members.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move DE3 to get the bill in the shape that I like.
Okay, we're going to move the amendment first. Any discussion on the DE3? Representative Smith, what's the DE3 doing?
Madam Chair, members, the DE3 amendment deals with Article 1, which is a new bill before this committee. However, Article 2, 3, and 4 have been heard in front of this committee before and passed without controversy.
Very good. Any discussion from members on the DE3? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the DE3, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE3 is before us, or 1372 as amended. Representative Smith, do you have a special guest with you today?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, we have Reagan Smith with us today to help give any testimony if needed for this important legislation for all the pets in the state of Minnesota.
And I believe I might have heard a little pre-bill testimony from Reagan earlier.
Madam Chair, perhaps, and my apologies on behalf of Reagan to the committee.
I think Reagan was just being the protective dog that she is. Representative Smith, to the new portion of the bill, if you might want to go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, pet trusts in Minnesota are not allowed right now, and pet trusts are very important. More American adults have pets than they do children. Nearly 9 out of 10 adults view their pets as part of their family. Pet ownership gives physical and psychological and economic benefits, and also potentially affords long-term reductions in both private and public health care expenses. Pets can also play a very important role in someone's life who is incapacitated or near the end of their life. A pet trust, the statute is necessary in Minnesota today because under a will, you cannot give money legally to a pet. Also, any money that you give to a pet needs to go through probate, which is costly and timely. Furthermore, wills are only effective at the death of the individual, of the testator, and if someone becomes incapacitated, those funds are not available for the care of the pet. And I have some expert testimony to give as well, Madam Chair.
Well, very fine. Thank you for being here. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Lake, I'm a solo practice law firm. I also represent the State Bar Association. The probate and trust law section of the bar is supportive of this legislation. I think Representative Smith did a good job of explaining, you can leave money to care for a pet under a will, but for the reasons he stated, it's really just kind of unworkable and an imperfect solution. This bill would enable a pet owner to leave funds and instructions for the care of their pet if they become incapacitated or after they die. I think it's important to note that the funds must be at a reasonable level for care of the pet. This is not something that people can use to stash away millions of dollars. The trust expires at the death of the pet, and then the funds would go to the testator's heirs. Also, this is not something that can be used to hide money, to protect money for medical assistance purposes. DHS can still access money that's in it, even if it's an irrevocable trust. And the final thing I'd note, Madam Chair, is we're the only state that doesn't have a pet trust statute. 49 other states have them, so this is about as mainstream an idea, I think, as will come before the committee this year. And I would say, in addition to Reagan, the bill is also supported by my three dogs, Frankie, Vita, and Rasta.
Very fine. Are there any... I think we might have an amendment. Representative Zerwas?
Madam Chair, I think we have an amendment that can be passed out. If you'd be willing to waive the 24-hour rule, then maybe would retitle the bill the Mittens the Kitten Act. And I think it would be appropriate for Representative Smith's bill. I think this is very important legislation, and the importance should be reflected in the title. Mittens
West,
the Kitten.
Thank you for that. I am willing to move or to waive that 24-hour rule if that's okay with the other side.
I appreciate that. I will withdraw the amendment, but I think it shows really the importance of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Any comments, Representative Smith?
No, Madam Chair, members, I appreciate Representative Zerwas withdrawing that amendment. And in conclusion,
I ask for your support, and on behalf of Reagan and our four-legged friends and all the pets in Minnesota, I ask for your support for this very important legislation. Thank you.
Are there any member questions? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, how would this change, Mr. Lake, I guess, would this change at all any tax implications for putting that money in trust versus doing it through the will?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it will not. Any taxation to the estate will happen prior to the placement of the funds, just as any taxation implications for the estate, for the recipients, if you give the money to a charity or to any other individual.
And
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not being supremely familiar with this area of law, why is it that you can't just do this in this provision in a will and you have to set up a trust to do it?
Mr. Lake.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, you can leave money for a pet in a will. There are a few problems with it, though. As Representative Smith mentioned, number one, the will has to go through probate, so that can take quite a bit of time, and during that time, the money's not available to care for the pet. The other significant problem is that those funds, it's not enforceable. So let's say I left $10,000 in my will with instructions for Representative Smith to take care of my dogs. Once he has that money, there's no way to enforce that he actually spends that money taking care of my dogs. Whereas with a trust, the trustee or the court-appointed person can ensure that the money is actually spent as intended. That just can't happen with a will.
Okay. Thank you. I would just note, you know, this is the first time I've heard a lot about this. The most I've heard about it since Leona Helmsley left her dog $12 million and made everyone really happy about her even more. So I can't wait till we have that in Minnesota. That'll be great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, to your point, a judge does have the ability, if they feel that the funds left to a pet is excessive, they can take money out of that trust and put it into the residual portion of the testator's estate. So we would not have that scenario in Minnesota that you alluded to.
Any other member questions? Is there any, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is that currently the process in law, or is that part of what you're setting up here? Do we do that in any other area of trust law?
Mr. Lake or Representative?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm uncertain about other areas of the trust code, but it is specifically in this bill at lines 2.33 and 2.34, where the court can determine that the value of the trust property exceeds the amount required for its intended use.
Any other member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 1372 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you to your testifiers. And thank you, Reagan. Representative Zerwas. Okay, Representative Zerwas, we have House File 3142. Would you like to move that?
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 3142 be re-referred, I believe, to the General Register.
Yes, that is correct. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is the department's policy bill. Of everything that's included in this bill, what I'm really interested in, I had a constituent issue with the issuance of temporary food permits. And so that's one of the sections covered in the bill. We also, in the bill, have language that deals with trauma designation. We also have information in the bill that talks about temporary suspension of licenses. An immediate temporary suspension of licenses for some home settings. I'll have the department walk through the bill had been through health reform and was non-controversial. I don't know what exact section applies here in civil law. Maybe we have staff clarify that.
Okay. It looks like members. It looks like Section 12, Subdivision 2A, is the only section of this bill that applies to our committee. So, if your testifier would like to address just that section, that would be terrific. Thank you for being here. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Melissa Finnegan. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. Section 12 does come under this community's jurisdiction. What this does is allows the department, when issuing a notification of disciplinary action to a hearing instrument dispenser, it allows us to provide notice of that action by person or by certified mail. Several repeats to offer it in person does get expensive. This is a change that was suggested to us by the Attorney General's office, and my understanding is it does align with current practice. Madam Chair, we are also prepared to speak to Sections 4, 5, and 6 on the temporary immediate suspension language if the committee believes that is under their jurisdiction.
Okay. Staff is telling me that's administrative law, so that doesn't apply.
Okay.
So any questions from members on this particular section, Section 12? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none there. Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 3142 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you to your testifier. Representative Zerwas, you have another bill.
Madam Chair, members, House File 3045, and I'll make the motion to refer that to the General Register.
Very well. House File, Representative Zerwas moves House File 3045 and recommend that it be sent to the General Register. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill comes following a program evaluation performed by the Office of Legislative Auditor. Following that, there were several recommendations after the program evaluation. This bill tries to accomplish as many of those as could be worked out with the stakeholder. This bill, just so everyone is aware, this bill currently looks significantly different in the Senate. A lot of amendments have been added on in the Senate, and my hopes is to get this to conference committee as close to the OLA's original recommendations as possible, and then sort out what we can get done within conference committee. With that, I think we have an assistant commissioner from DHS who can walk through the portions of the bill. And again, if staff could hone us in on the exact portions that are germane to this committee.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. My understanding is the only section that applies to our committee is 4.3 on page 4.3, subdivision 4, under the record keeping. Oh, and subdivision 3 before that, I'm told. So if welcome to the committee. If you want to keep your comments to those two sections, that would be much appreciated. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gilbert Acevedo. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. Under section, if I understand, section 2 and section 4 are the two areas?
Subdivision 3 at the bottom of page 3 and subdivision 4 on page 4.
Under the program evaluation for the HMO complaint process, the requirements and recommendations was to establish definitions and filing and having documentation so that the Department of Health can come in and look at documents that the HMOs have, and part of it is also the reporting requirement so that records are maintained, identifying those categories that are within peer protection or actually identified as confidential so that we know what's in peer protection, what's not in peer protection, so that the Department of Health has the ability to come in during either investigations or our triannual quality reviews to look at those documentation. So this bill, what it does is identifies those areas. It also establishes that the HMOs maintain records so that when we come in and during those reviews or investigations, so that we can look exactly what was established during their investigations.
Very fine. Are there any member questions? Seeing none, are there any members of the audience that wish to testify for or against this bill?
Madam Chair, I know of at least two members of the audience that are here to testify.
It looks like Ms. Van Pelt is here, if you'd like to come forward. All right. If the pages can, I think she's handed off a clipboard there, then she can help you. Thank you. Go ahead and have a seat and state your name for the record.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Van Pelt. To all of you, and I sincerely say this, thank you for voting for this to be a program evaluation that was reality. I've been at the legislature for 5 years, really attempting to get to a point, not even believing I'd get this far, but did. My reason for being here is I have been the customer of the Minnesota Department of Health and two concurrent Minnesota Department of Health investigations, one for a facility investigation and one for an HMO investigation. And with the pamphlets that I, or the two pieces of information I gave you, if you could open up to the one that says my first five objectives, you know, that have been concurrent for the last number of years, or the same. On this particular page are the two kinds of investigations I've had done. So we have the Office of Health Facility Complaints, and it is a much more open investigative style. You can read in the paper about a facility investigation where there's been harm to, let's just say, the Hermantown rape case of an elderly woman. You can read about St. Peter's facility, anything of that nature that is really helpful to us. Okay, and then when you have a Minnesota Department of Health investigation, it is locked, solid, closed. So when I began the investigation into the, having an HMO investigation, at the very beginning I am told that I won't be able to find the results to the investigation. I won't be able to find out anything as the complainant. And I want to let you know this, and I've talked about this with the Minnesota Department of Health a number of times. We are losing people before we even begin. Why would you even want to do it? And that was my very question to the investigator. Why would I want to do this if I don't get to know the outcome of the investigation? Especially when we have one within the same division that is much more open. When we have peer review investigations, I'm sure many people would love to have peer review investigations. I'm sure a facility would love to have a peer review. I am actually quite confident, like the Dan Markinson case, I'm sure they would have loved to have it just remained a peer review and nothing more, no one reported and to the public. And I think what's really true, I'm a Catholic, and I look at this. With the Catholic sexual abuse case, I'm sure priests, God forbid I'm saying this, you know, wouldn't they love it if they could do a peer review? And then we don't get to know about it, and the people that are harmed in their midst. The Eric Dean case, you know, look at, we benefit when we know. So what I want to read to you is even what Governor Arne Carlson wrote, again, about the University of Minnesota and all of this work. I'm not disparaging of people, but I come to you with facts and data, undisputed facts and data, that have allowed me to get this far, to question so intently. And if I have ever lied about anything, I would have been thrown out under the bus and out of this building years ago, because I'm talking about some subject lines that are not very sexy. Lobbyists work hard to keep, you know, what they have going. And I'm looking to be the voice of the consumer, the complainant who walks into the door and gets themselves listened to, their voices heard, their data respected. Because one-sided investigations done in the state doesn't cut it. We allow the HMOs to investigate themselves, report their findings back to the state, and currently through the OLA program evaluation, we learned that no one even has access to the data they are giving currently. They don't even know if it's authentic. And so with so many of the things I agree with the OLA on, there are 3 points that I would like to touch on that would get passed further. But first off, I want to read with the U of M. It was written by Arne Carlson, and two quotes in here. One is by Jim Nobles regarding this program evaluation. The university constructed a defense to deny liability by claiming immunity. I think that defense evolved on what, on you might say, devolved into a strategy to simply avoid any accountability or responsibility and to deny that there were any serious ethical issues. And we found there were ethical issues and conflicts of interest just permeated this case. And Governor Arne Carlson wrote, "But the reality is that any management system can deny wrongdoing and block calls for an independent investigation. When Eric Haler took the reins as president of the university in 2011, he had already been sent material by Dr. Carl Elliott, a critic of the university's handling of the Dan Markinson case, and faculty members of the Centers for Bioethics. In his 2010 article for Mother Jones magazine, Elliott wrote about the issues of poor standards, conflicts of interest involving all-too-cozy relationships with drug companies and lack of independent oversight, and the way the threat of involving involuntary commitment was used to coerce Markinson into the drug study." What all this means is right now, when we have no insight whatsoever to the outcomes of the investigations, and even with the proposals made with the OLA in this regard, there still is nothing for the complainant. Where do we get, you know, just satisfaction of knowing? And peer reviews, I want to say this. You can redact data. If you look at the Office of Health Facility Complaints, you can go on their website, and you can read investigation results, and you get to read a lot of different things, but they'll redact the names, but you get at the heart of it. It lets us know what's going on. It keeps an eye on to what is really important. And if you turn to the list of recommendations that I have highlighted 3 points that I have really consistently been about since the beginning. Again, so many things with OLA program evaluation I agree with. I agree with all of them, but I push more. I push for more because that's what my facts and data as that complainant has. And I'm just going to say, for the one I have highlighted, the first one, the legislature, in consultation with the Minnesota Department of Health, should define the types of problems or issues that should be investigated as confidential quality of care complainants. And I again ask, why is it confidential? When we allow peer reviews that remain confidential, like the Catholic Church, like the Eric Dean case, like any of them, the system is ripe for abuse. It's another point. The legislature should give the Minnesota Department of Health full regulatory authority over and access to health maintenance organizations' confidential investigation into quality care complaints. Again, why confidential? And I will point this out to you specifically why I speak so strongly. I have had those 2 out of 2 investigations done, one with a facility, one with an HMO. Minnesota Department has cleared each of them of wrongdoing. I continue to press away on the facts and the data, and believe me, I have facts and data to be before you today. And when I asked the CEO of the HMO if you can commit whether you told the truth to the Minnesota Department of Health and to the administrator of the facility, I met with answers of no comment or actions taken where the HMO puts their director of risk management in to handle me, and I ask, what risk are they assessing? Eventually, both organizations turned to medical malpractice defense law firms against me, apparently. And I'm asking the questions. And when I ask, why doesn't it matter to the state? And I have many, many high-level people on copy in those communications to the HMO CEO, later their attorney, the facility administrator, later their attorney. Why doesn't it matter to the state when I am throwing so many red flags out there? I am not met with of any good answer whatsoever. Commissioner Ellinger told me he would give me quality answers to these questions. He told me that in January of 2015. He has yet to meet with me. I am asking for there to be more transparency and accountability. And when this investigation outcomes lie with just the Minnesota Department of Health, and my questions are of no concern to the state, I cannot leave it be that it remains just with the Minnesota Department of Health for the very reasons that the questions aren't being answered. Lastly, the Minnesota Department of Health on that point should forward all quality of care complaints it receives to the appropriate professional related licensing board or state agency for investigations. We can currently, we can do that right now. We can do it with Office of Health facility complaints. I could have done it with the Minnesota Department of Health investigation, but there is a place to investigate the HMO, just like there is to investigate a facility. There are systemic issues that are in there in each of them. And if we look just to boards to do it, we are missing the point. I had a very strong systemic issue with the HMO, not just on one period date where it had been related to one doctor or one nurse. It was over a period of time that is undeniable. And so with that, I am so grateful to be before you today. I'm so grateful to have earned your votes. I'm grateful for the great work Joe Voss did, Jody Rodriguez, and Ellen Demmer from the Minnesota, or from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, for Mr. Nobles, for meeting with me on several occasions, to the Minnesota Department of Health, where if they can know I want to work with them versus against them, to you. Thank you. And I've moved really with this bill to look more towards what we have in the Senate file. You know that I've been consistently pushing for that, to go above and beyond confidentiality. It has no place if we are to serve the public. And again, who are we protecting when we keep confidential? Because I sure as hell don't feel served. And I bet I speak on behalf of any of you, if you were going through this yourself, you would like to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Van Pelt. We have one more testifier, I believe. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. If you could keep your comments to just the areas of the bill that are before us today, that
would be great. My name is Jim Groats, and I am insurance licensed, I am advisory licensed, and I am securities licensed. I've been licensed for over 40 years in securities. I'm here speaking to you as a private individual. I have a couple of questions or some comments on the bill summary for this bill. And Section 1, it states a peer review. And in the securities business, as long as I have been in it, peer is defined as only one participant from the industry and two independents. And I believe that peer here, it means peer, your working peers. What does that mean? I just wanted to point out to you that this is far different than allowed in the rest of the insurance business and securities business. And it's also, we don't even allow this with juries. That would be biased juries. Next point I have is regarding to HMOs in Section 2, quality of care to report annually. The rest of the insurance business, securities and advisory, financial planning, everyone else in the business, we have specific standards that have been drawn, and it has to be reported within 30 days for the most part. I just want to point that out to your attention. Record keeping, that's under the record keeping requirements. On the back of the bill summary, it shows that this is to be effective January 1 of 2018. That's entirely too late. There's no reason it can't be effective immediately upon passing. Record keeping requirements under subdivision 3, it would be better instead of 5 years if we went to 6 years to be consistent with the rest of the insurance industry and everything else in this area. I have a question on confidential data, last section, subdivision 4. Does that mean, I understand that would be confidential data for individuals. Madam Chair, does that mean that it would be, and Representative, does it mean it would also be confidential for the HMOs?
Mr. Guerin, you want to take that one?
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, confidential data means, for purposes of the Data Practices Act, that it's only accessible to the agency itself. So data subjects are not allowed to access the data. So whether the data subject is the individual or the HMO, they would, neither of those entities would be allowed to access this data.
Okay. As a follow-up question, sir, does that mean that, I assume that would mean in this bill that the complainant wouldn't have a right to know the outcomes of the complaint?
Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, yeah, yes, that's correct.
Testifier.
I would favor the Senate bill language. I'm disappointed in that. I just wanted to also point out some things. Yesterday...
Only as it pertains to the sections that were...
okay. I'm just also stating, if you look at, you know, talking about disclosure, look at the front headline of today's newspaper, Star Tribune. This is hours old. Medical notes stir healthy talk. We've got doctors sharing their information unfiltered. It's just simply time that these health plans enter the modern era of consumer protection. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll answer any questions.
Were there any questions from the members for either of the past two testifiers? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 3045 is recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted, and it's on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Before we adjourn, folks, we will be having one more meeting on possibly some informational basis only on Tuesday on a couple of bills. So with that, we are adjourned.